It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And if you have a pond, a lake, or even a water feature, you know it's hard to nurture the plant life that you want while preventing the plant life that you don't want. This hour, we'll get some tips from Alan Patillo, Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist. Of course, we'll also be answering your questions as the hour goes on about all of the plants in your life. Alan is with me now. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, let's talk about prevention first, because we all know how this works. When you get a lot of sunshine and you've got some nitrogen in the water, things kind of explode. So right now, at this point in the year, if you've got a pond or a lake or even a water feature, is there something you can do to prevent that algae explosion a little later on?
Yeah, I mean, it's really all about nutrients, right? The first thing you do is you protect your watershed. So that means doing all of the land cover practices that we would do to take up nutrients. A lot of that would be prairie. If you have the ability to have a wetland, something to sequester nutrients and take sediments out of the water column, that's definitely going to help out a lot. The second thing besides nutrients is light. So if you're limiting light, you know, less plants are able to grow in the water. There's lots of different ways to do that. Some ways you can do, like, a kind of a non-toxic way might be to add some dye into the water. If you do that early enough on in the season, that will reduce the amount of light penetration into the water, and so certain plants won't be able to grow through the bottom areas of the pond. But it's all about nutrient reduction and prevention, and nutrient reduction has really been the name of the game here in Iowa recently. Lots of nitrogen. They're going through the tile lines and going just through the groundwater in general and off people's lawns. And nitrogen control is definitely a big issue here.
So, of course, you see a lot of farm ponds, for example, and people love to mow right around the edge. They like to have access to the pond and a nice short lawn next to it. Is that working against us?
Well, it depends on what you're really wanting to manage for. So, you know, mowing down to the edge of the pond and keeping the weeds low right there around the edge, one thing that you're sort of inviting into that area is going to be Canada geese. You're sort of managing against mosquitoes if you're keeping the grass low at that particular level. It gives them less places to hide at. And, you know, you would be able to do some snail control there as well if that's issue for you. Adding light into that area, if you're cutting back cattails and things like that, other plants are going to take up those nutrients. So it really depends on what you want to manage for.
All right. So in an ideal world, is there kind of a balance that you see people striking with maybe a little bit of wetland or prairie type area, but still maintaining their access?
Around the pond, you're going to need to have a buffer area around the pond to take up those nutrients. If you're able to take maybe the upstream portion of the watershed where the water really funnels into the pond, you can sort of get the most bang for your buck if you put the prairie in that area, as well as some wetland area in that stream area just upstream of the pond. And you can have other areas where you have good access, where you mow it and manicure it. You know, the dam in particular should always be mowed and manicured, because you don't want trees growing on there because you have potentials for blowouts on the pond if those willow trees blow over.
All right. Let's talk about more desirable plants. So we know we need to try to limit the nitrogen, but of course people kind of fall in love with different kinds of water plants. If you have a specific kind of water plant that you want to grow, can you give us some advice for some of the more popular ones?
Well, I think the ones that have pretty flowers are typically something that people like to grow. So things like American lotus or, water lilies, you know, maybe arrowhead and it really is based on personal preference. A lot of those plants have floating surface leaves. That's going to limit light penetration into the pond also, if you have that. And so you'll have less, maybe phytoplankton growth in the water. So that's that single-celled algae that makes the water turn really green. A lot of people don't like that. But in general, we really recommend that you have between 15 and 25% of your total pond surface area with some sort of aquatic plant. just to strike up a good ecological balance so that you've got places for your juvenile fish to grow and sort of all those little benthic macroinvertebrates that live there, so they'll have food to eat. And then the rest of it you can leave as sort of an open water area.
So do you have recommendations? Obviously, people like pretty flowers, but do you have plants that you think work particularly well?
You know, that's like I said, really up to personal preference. I know the ones that people dislike, for the most part, are going to be duckweed. There's filamentous algae that's definitely a big problem. And those tend to take up the center area of the pond quite a bit. Cattails are some that will spread very quickly. I mean, I find them personally attractive, but they also can take over and spread out into a pond because they spread through the root rhizome. I think blue flag is one of those plants that's very attractive. They have a nice purpley-blue flower, and they're an emergent plant, so they come out of the surface of the water.
And I'm not familiar with that. Can you describe what it looks like?
It looks like an iris, sort of, yeah.
All right. And so that would be something that you'd plant at the edge and it would spread?
Yes, absolutely. You could plant a few plugs and it'll spread across that area pretty quickly.
When you plant, you mentioned cattails and how they spread. Do you have a good resource for people for knowing how quickly something will spread? Because obviously you want to have an idea of what's going to happen with that plant over the next couple of years.
That's a good point, and honestly, I don't have a good answer for you. Do you know about that, Richard?
Nope, they're just very, very aggressive, and just be careful as far as what you want because they tend to kind of take over.
Right. You know, those corn dogs is what I call them. They're seed pods. Whenever they blow up, they float on top of the water. They can blow to all the edges, and you know, if you're trying to manage against cattails, they really do well in water that's 3 feet or less. So, you know, certain areas of the pond that have that sort of area, they're going to grow out there pretty quick. And if you do need to manage those, more than just chemicals, you really need to remove those root rhizomes because they spread very quickly that way. And maybe one really good way to do that would be sort of a track hoe, just removing soil around the edge of the pond.
And cattails are native to Iowa, right?
Yes, they certainly are. They do really well in this habitat.
All right. And there are also non-native cattails as well. Is that an issue at all in the state?
I have not heard much of an issue with non-native cattails.
Okay. I've read a few things about hybrid cattails that just sort of bring the natives and the non-natives together and spread even more aggressively. So I was curious to see if that was something that's happening in the state of Iowa as well. When somebody is looking for aquatic plants, you know, we've talked a lot in the past weeks about how to make a plan when you go to the garden center and make sure that you know how much space you have and all of that. Do people tend to get a little overzealous when buying aquatic plants too?
I'm sure that could certainly happen. You know, think about what the size of the plant's going to be whenever it reaches maturity, and you know, you're going to want to space those out so that the leaves will have enough space to grow, you know, probably just depending on the root or the leaf form of those plants, something like a cattail because it's so narrow and tall, you might be able to plant a little bit closer. Things like arrowhead, they have broad leaves. You're going to want to plant those further apart, maybe a foot or so.
And you talked about managing your pond or your lake for what you want. So let's say you're hoping to have a strong fish population. What kinds of plants make it a really welcoming environment?
A lot of submerged aquatic plants do a really good job of providing that habitat the fish are looking for. It's really all about creating a food resource. I mean, and honestly, you're looking for a balance of a lot of different things. So the single-celled phytoplankton, those are going to be food for zooplankton, which are the little microcrustaceans. And those are directly food for juvenile fish. They're also food for larger benthic macroinvertebrates that are then food for some of the medium-sized fish, like your bluegill and that. And, you know, as you go up the food chain, these little fish feed the bigger fish. So you need a variety of different types of plants. in the water. Some of these provide more of a structure, habitat, place to hide, whereas some of the other ones provide more of a food resource that the fish can eat.
It seems like we have kind of a push and pull between people love to have nice, clear water for boating, for swimming, for other kinds of water recreation. But we also need a more complicated habitat for fish, but also for other wild creatures as well. If you want to have a strong frog population, for example, and really support nature, you've got to have more of a mix. Am I right about that?
I would definitely agree with that. Diversity is always a good thing.
What do you feel are some of the major challenges facing people right now? I mean, we've talked about nitrogen. Is that still the biggest problem that people who are trying to have a healthy water environment face?
I would say it's almost 100% of the time nitrogen is the issue. You know, other things that you can have problems with, is particularly if you're trying to avoid a fish kill, sometimes spray over from agricultural applications of herbicides can cause direct toxicity to either the plants or the fish or the invertebrates. And all of those really affect the food chain in that environment.
Do you recommend testing your water to know what's in it?
It certainly wouldn't hurt anything. And if you are looking to test your water, I know the University Hygienic Laboratories, the State Hygienic Laboratory, is going to be a good resource for you there.
Okay, so go ahead and look that up and maybe submit a sample. Is that something you'd want to do on an annual basis?
It really depends on how much money you want to spend, too. You know, some of these tests can be fairly expensive. I think you get a suite of maybe 10 tests for about $200, so depends on what you want to spend.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me this hour, Alan Patillo, Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist. He's here to answer your questions. Of course, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here to answer your questions about the things you'd like to grow or grow better. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the program with your questions about all of the plants in your life. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Alan Patillo, Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist, and Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron is here now. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Now, last week when we were talking about it being Mother's Day and time to plant tomatoes, I told you that my colleague Dean Borg said, no, you have to wait for the three kings, the three frozen kings. And he's feeling pretty smug today as we're talking about possible freeze warnings.
Well, that's Northern Iowa. That's almost like another country.
Right. So it is going to be a cool weekend.
Yes, it is.
All right. So anything we should be doing to take precautions if we did get out and get our tomatoes and peppers planted last weekend?
Well, in Northern Iowa, they may have to cover them either with a light blanket or a sheet, something that basically would keep them a little bit warmer. So I think the rest of us should be okay.
All right. And of course, if you didn't get them in last weekend, there is still time.
Absolutely.
All right.
You may want to wait till Sunday.
Yeah, I think I will. Maybe even Monday. All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Cheryl is on the line in Pilot Mound. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I have a question about asparagus. The last 2 years, it seemed to be on the decline in this old bed that we have here. And what I'm wondering about is, does asparagus have a lifespan or possibly, you know how it always grows in ditches, it seems like. So I don't think grass would be a problem, but it is in the midst of some very thick grass. So I just wondered what your thoughts are on whether I should even harvest it this year.
Well, if it has a good site and it's well cared for, it can't be productive for 20 or more years. So it's a long-term thing. Now, obviously, if it's a poor site as far as soil conditions, if it's poorly managed, then it may decline much quicker. If the spears are very, very small, They're very spindly. What you may want to do is if you have been harvesting, you may want to end your harvest early this year. Let's say maybe late May. And if you have a lot of grass in the asparagus, what you might want to do is go ahead and go out in late May and make your last harvest of the season. And at that point, go out there and cut every single spear that is above ground to just below the ground. Okay.
Okay.
And then go out the very same day and spot treat with Roundup and get rid of that and get rid of that grass competition. Get rid of that because the grass is a pretty aggressive competitor and you want to get it out of there.
Okay.
And that's the only chance you really have to get rid of it is immediately after the last harvest. Then maybe go ahead and maybe fertilize a little bit, use like a 10-10-10, and hopefully the asparagus will do better. Now, if it doesn't, let's say next spring it comes up and it's still very, very spindly, that might be a clue that, well, maybe it's time to plant a new bed and do that.
All right. Cheryl, thank you so much for your call. And we've got another asparagus question on the line. So let's stick with asparagus for just a moment. Hank is with us in Washington. Hi, Hank.
Howdy.
What's your question?
I think maybe that was my question.
Oh, okay.
My asparagus bed is doing the same thing, spindly and going ahead. And that now I have not been cutting it off below ground level or at ground level. Could that be a problem?
Well, the only time you cut it below ground level is on the last harvest when you're going to use Roundup, because Roundup only kills those plants that are sprayed directly. And if you
My problem wouldn't be with grass.
Okay,
mine's pretty clean.
Okay, so again, you may want to stop harvesting early this year and maybe fertilize and see what happens.
With the 10-10-10.
Right. And I'd put on maybe about a pound per 100 square feet. So not a whole lot, but around a pound per 100 square feet.
How many square feet? 100 square feet?
1 pound per 100 square feet.
Okay, I've got you. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Hank. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We've got a question for you, Alan, from Jack in Des Moines. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, I was going to see if they had any suggestions for control of a combination of duckweed and watermeal on a farm pond. Doesn't get much turnover in the water. It's 10 acres of runoff feeding a one-acre pond, so it kind of stagnates. And I also have a lot of runoff from a horse field next door to me that's going in the pond. I'm sure that's contributing, but I want to know if you have any suggestions for control.
Right, yeah. So duckweed is one of the, and watermeal both are particularly difficult to get rid of because they tend to double their population every day whenever the temperature is right and whenever they got enough water nutrients. And so one thing that we do is we try to push those floating plants to the edge of the pond. And typically, ponds in Iowa, the wind does that for you, but if it's protected by the woods, when there's not a lot of wind action, they'll cover that pond up and take up all the light that the other plants were going to use. So a lot of people will put in an aerator diffuser type system, and that'll help push some of that duckweed away from the center and allow a little bit of light in there to get some competition with some other types of plants. And also, you know, that manure, it tends to spread phosphorus and other types of nutrients that those plants need quite a bit. So if you can sort of cut that source off a little bit and filter that water before it comes into your pond, that would be to your benefit.
Okay. Any chemical suggestions, chemical control?
So looking at my thing here, Floridone is something that works pretty well. One trade name might be Sonar. Let's see if there's anything else. Pinoxalam is another one, P-E-N-O-X-S-U-L-A-M.
Could you repeat that for me, please? I'm just writing that down.
Pinoxalam, P-E-N-O-X-S-U-L-A-M.
Okay.
Yeah, one trade name would be Galleon for that.
Okay. All right. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Jack. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And here's a question from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. I'm wondering if I can get away with setting aside a corner or a small section of my lawn to establish some native flora. Can I set it apart with some stone bordering, rip up the existing lawn, and then plant prairie plants? Would this setup be sustainable, and would it be of any use to the animals and insects that thrive on prairie plants? Of course, I would do research to ensure that the prairie flora I plant would do well in my particular soil conditions.
Sure, you can make it as big as you want. You can start out small. You can put in, for example, butterfly milkweed, purple coneflower, asters, goldenrod. They're actually sold at garden centers. You can also put in some native grasses, maybe a little blue stem, prairie drop seed. So you can make it as big as you want.
All right. And she seems to be concerned about it spreading into the rest of the lawn. That's not really a worry,
typically,
right?
It's not. No, they're not that aggressive.
All right. In fact, for people who've tried really, really hard.
Right. They're disappointed.
Right. I'd like them to be a little more aggressive. All right. You can call with your questions 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Next up, we've got Desiree in Alta, Illinois. Hi, Desiree.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a question. We have three ash trees. They're probably 10 to 20 years old in our yard, and we really don't want to lose them. And we're wondering what's the best treatment for them. We've heard of a couple of different ways that they treat the trees, and we're just wondering, is there any way we can save these trees?
Well, there are insecticides that you can use. Now, if the trees are less than 12 inches in diameter, 4.5 feet above the ground, you can do it yourself, where you go out with a chemical and you apply this around the trunk of the tree and you water it in. It works very easily. And so that would be the easiest, cheapest method. Now, if they're bigger than 12 inches in diameter, you're going to have it done by a certified applicator. So the cost is going to be obviously more on that. But you can treat. Most of the homeowner products basically last a single year, so they're effective for 1 year. Some of the more commercial products will last for 2 years as far as providing control or prevention for 2 years.
Okay. Now, we had been told that there's a way they can do it through the roots or actually boring into the tree. Is there a better way to do that? We don't want the tree to end up being harmed.
Right. There's various ways that commercial people can do it. One is to inject the chemical into the trunk, so they do make some small holes in the trunk of the tree. But if they do that properly, that should not be a big problem for the tree itself. Some materials you can actually spray on the bark, and the bark will absorb it. So it kind of depends upon the chemical as far as how they apply it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, Desiree, thanks a lot for your call. And Richard, a lot of people are worried about these chemicals and the cost that they may have for the environment around this beloved tree. What's the latest?
Well, I think what they're mainly concerned about is imidacloprid, which is a very common insecticide, and bees being very sensitive to that material. The nice thing is that the ash has a flower that really doesn't attract bees to it much, so it shouldn't be that much of an issue.
Okay, but if you start treating, you pretty much have to do it forever, right?
Well, right. Unless your goal is to maybe plant some other trees and give those new trees a time to grow and get bigger and then eventually kind of phase out the green ash.
All right. Next, let's go to Dustin in East Moline. Hi, Dustin.
Hello, Charity. I have a question about some lilacs. I have a couple of lilac bushes in my yard. One very old established. We've been here 20 years, and it was well established when we got here. It's growing beautifully, but almost no flowers.
Hmm. Has that been a yearly thing or just recently?
It seems to have faded over the past few years, less and less each year.
Does it get at least 6 hours of direct sun?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Have you been pruning it at all?
Gently over the years.
Okay. And when do you prune it?
After it blooms.
Okay. Those are two things that I was concerned about. If they don't get enough sun, they won't bloom very well. They need at least 6 hours of direct sun. If they're pruned sometime, let's say in mid to late summer, early fall, then they may not bloom very well the next year. So those are two issues. But apparently that's not the case. So I'm not sure exactly what's going on. I guess I would be inclined maybe to, if it's an older plant, I might be inclined to early next spring or late winter, maybe select maybe three or four of the largest, oldest branches and cut those off near the ground and kind of over time get rid of some of the older growth and get some new growth. And hopefully that new growth would bloom better as it grows. So I might try that.
But do this before it blooms?
Right, right. So you're going to go out probably sometime in March, early April, before the plant does anything, and you're going to take out maybe two or three of the largest, oldest stems, and they can be quite big in size as far as diameter, and cut those off near the ground, and that will encourage new growth. And this is kind of a long-term project where you get rid of some of the old growth, and hopefully that new growth will bloom nicely in maybe 2 or 3 years.
All right. Dustin, good luck with that. Let's go next to Heather in Des Moines. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
Hi, what's
your
question?
I'm
good.
My question is, I heard you say earlier in the program that unless you're in northern Iowa, you don't need to worry about covering tomatoes and peppers. But I just put a whole flat of basil in. Do I need to cover that tonight?
I would think not. I think their forecasting temperature is in the upper 30s. I think that should be okay. Now, I would probably listen to the forecast this evening to make sure. They might change their mind. And if they're saying possibly low 30s, then I would cover them with a light blanket or sheet.
And if Heather's just a little nervous, should she just do that anyway?
Well, she can always do that, but if you don't really have to, why?
that's what I was thinking.
So I would just listen to the forecast this evening and see what they're saying. And if they're pretty confident, then I would probably let it go.
All right. Thank you. Yep. Good luck with that, Heather. We'll all keep our fingers crossed. Tom is on the line in Cedar Rapids, a very similar problem to an earlier caller. Hi, Tom.
Hello there.
Hi. Yeah, so what's going on with your pond?
Okay. It's a farm pond, very similar to the one, the gentleman that was in Des Moines. Several years ago, during a downpour, my terrace broke and filtered it in some. Since then, it is, instead of 17 feet deep, it's roughly 9 feet at the best. And it is getting to where the plant life in it, you can hardly row across the pond. Is this time to have it dug out, or is it a case of let it go back to swamp? We use it for fishing and in that type of recreation.
Right, yeah. So one of the main concerns with a shallow pond, aside from the plant growth increase that you're going to get from having that deeper light penetration relative to the soil bottom, is just that you don't have that much space for oxygen whenever it freezes over in the wintertime. I don't know what you have in terms of land down gradient from your pond currently. Some people, I think it would be cheaper for them to build an additional dam down below their current pond and basically use the existing pond as a sediment basin to help capture some of the sediments and nutrients and basically let that turn into a wetland, whereas the downhill pond would turn into your more sport fish pond.
I'm not opposed to that, except that I'm on the edge of my property and the neighbor has a pond below me. So
you're providing that service for him.
Yeah, okay. Yes.
Maybe you guys could sign a treaty or something.
Maybe I could fish his pond.
Yeah. So in terms of that, whenever you go through and dredge the pond, which can be quite expensive, I'll be honest with you, you may have to drain it at least partially, if not most of the way to start with. I've heard as much as $30,000
oh.
people spend on that. But create a sediment basin so you don't have that problem again.
All right. Well, good luck, Tom. Thanks a lot for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to answer more questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Alan Patillo, Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist, and Richard Giron, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jim is on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
What's your question?
Well, I am interested in permaculture, and I've been looking at maybe planting some nut trees. And I understand that there have been some different diseases going through different nut populations in Iowa, and I'm wondering which kind of nuts I would have the best luck with in growing around here.
Well, in northern Iowa...
Okay,
in northern Iowa, your best bet would be basically black walnut. We are seeing problems, disease problems with butternut. Pecans probably are not reliably hardy in northern Iowa, so it's basically black walnut and maybe some of the hickories.
Jim, what about hazelnuts? Are you thinking about shrubs too, or just trees?
Honestly, I haven't considered that, but that would be good.
You could definitely grow the hazelnut, American hazelnut, that is a shrub, grows about maybe 6, 7, 8 foot tall.
Okay.
All right. Well, Jim, that gives you a couple options. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Let's get a couple email questions in here. This one's from Kirk in Iowa City. We're restoring a wooded space that has up to 6 inches of spring-fed water at its base. Also, there's a steep embankment with slight erosion. It's also a heavily shaded area. Are there plants that we should consider for the wetland and eroding areas?
I'd probably put in things maybe like ferns, things that basically like damp, shady areas. And we have many native ferns that would probably do just fine. As far as...
what was that wild ginger that I got at the plant sale?
Right, you could plant that. There are a number of plants that typically you find in woodland settings that you could definitely put in there. As far as the very, very wet areas, that may be a little bit more problematic as far as the shady areas.
Alan, anything come to your mind for wetland but well-shaded?
Well, that's pretty much going to turn into a stream right there.
Right?
As far as I can tell, unless he really wants to take some trees out to provide some light. But, yeah, that'd be kind of a tough one.
All right. Let's do another email question here. This one is from Kelly in Des Moines. We moved into our new home last summer and this spring discovered that we have a lilac bush in our yard. It needs a little TLC. What would you suggest for helping the bush grow a little bigger and fuller?
Basically, not much they need to do. I guess maybe water the plant if we're having an extremely dry summer, and cutting out any dead wood. And possibly early in the spring, maybe a little bit of fertilizer. That's basically it.
All right. This one's from Jody, and it may be a little outside of your expertise area, Alan, but we'll give it a try. We have about a third-acre pond in our backyard that we created about 10 years ago. We've been successful keeping a game fish population, catfish, bass, bluegill, and a couple of grass carp. Perhaps unfortunately, every year we have a pair of Canada geese that have nested around the pond. Rarely do we see ducks. Last fall, we tied mallard decoys to our airline and left them in the pond over the winter to encourage ducks. We'd really love to see wood ducks as there's a stand of trees near the pond. Any suggestion on how to encourage more ducks?
That's a good question. We actually do
a
have
wildlife a wildlife specialist question.
We do have a wildlife specialist now. His name's Adam Janke. I don't have his phone number here handy, but you can find him through our Natural Resource Ecology and Management Department. And he's actually a bird person. He does a lot with pheasants as well as waterfowl. So that'd be a really good question to direct towards him. But if they're not really in a flyway, I mean, maybe eventually they'll discover it. But you can put out, you know, nesting boxes for them. That's something that would help out for sure.
All right. And we'll have Adam on the show here in the not too distant future, I'm sure. So maybe that question will wait for then as well. Here's a question from Scott in Des Moines. If you're not worried about thyme and the surrounding grass is smothering creeping Charlie, an effective method of removing it from the lawn?
Well, I'm not sure the grass is going to smother the creeping Charlie.
Well, he's wondering if he can use like black plastic or cardboard. He doesn't care about the grass, I guess.
Okay. Well, you could cover it with a tarp. Heavy-duty tarp, and just leave it covered for maybe 2 or 3 months, and eventually that probably would smother the existing plants. The problem is, if the plants were blooming this spring, they produced a lot of seed, and so you can destroy what's there, but undoubtedly some of that seed will germinate next spring, and you're going to have it back again. So,
okay, so that's
maybe kind of temporary.
And you'll have killed your grass also.
So I guess what you could try doing would be to maybe cover the area with a tarp, kill it out, and then maybe go out in early September with some grass seed and try to get a really, really dense grass established so that next spring fewer of the ground ivy seeds germinate. You could try that.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Helen is on the line in Ames. Hi, Helen. What's your question?
Hi, here I am.
Good, good. What's your question?
My question is, my neighbor suggested me to use this preen, and that's P-R-E-E-N, because I had some of these, I don't know what kind of weeds they are, but they have 1,000 roots on them. And since I've used that, it seems like I've planted like basil and thyme and things like that. They die.
Well, preen is a very common herbicide. It's a pre-emergent herbicide, which means that it prevents the germination of seed, and ideally weed seed, okay? But it should have no effect on growing established plants. So if your plants are dying, there's something else involved here, because preen is strictly a pre-emergent herbicide.
Huh. It seems like I planted garlic over that way, too, and the garlic is really skinny. Maybe it's my soil.
Well, that could be. Most of your plants do best in a moist, well-drained soil. They need plenty of sun, so.
Yeah. Well, thank you so very much. Here is blaming my neighbor.
All right. Well, good luck, Helen. Thanks a lot for your call. Yep. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Kathy's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Charity.
Hi. What's your question?
I have two questions about kind of shrub-related questions. Question one, I have a couple of Korean lilacs that are established. They've been in my yard for a few years. And I'd like to know, they're not blooming and they're not getting enough sun. So would I have success in moving them? That's first question. Second question, just need advice. I know you hear this a lot about volunteer trees and how to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Advice
well,
on that, please.
Yeah. As far as the Korean lilac, if they're not too big, you could move them. Now is not the best time, though. I would wait and I would wait and do it early next spring, before they begin to leaf out, and I would maybe kind of tie them up a little bit so they're kind of compacted, and then I would go out with a spade and dig them up, and make sure you have a nice ball of soil around each plant. Put them right back in the ground, water them nicely, and they probably should survive. Now, if they're really huge, what you might want to do is go ahead and prune them back first to make them more compact and again dig them up. As far as the volunteer trees, obviously you can dig them up or pull them out if you can. If that's not feasible, then I would cut them off and I would apply Roundup directly to the cut surface.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call, Kathy. Next, we've got Ron on the line in Clear Lake. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
What's your question?
I am I have a ash tree that's about 12 and a half feet around, and it's quite large, and it is forks about 6 feet up above the ground, and it has been cabled before to keep it from splitting. It's very healthy. Does have some exposed wood, but I'm wondering if it's worth treating that plant and having it recabled, or just destroy it.
Well, the fortunate thing is the emerald ash borer has not been found in the northwest third of Iowa, so at this point you don't have to worry about treating right now. As far as additional tree work like cabling and bracing, what you might want to do on that is to contact a certified arborist, have them come out, give you their opinion, and if they suggest cabling and bracing, the cost. And then you can think about that as far as the cost and whether you want to do that or not. It can be very expensive. One option might be to maybe plant some other trees in the area with the kind of long-term goal of maybe phasing out this bigger tree and establishing other trees. So, but I would definitely have a certified arborist come out and look at the tree, give me their opinion, and if they suggest additional work, the cost of doing that.
Well, and let me just bring up some things that Mark Vitosh has said on the program about the emerald ash borer in the past, that A, even if it's not there yet,
it will get there.
It will get there.
Right.
And then if you have a tree that has an injury, it's even more vulnerable to the emerald ash borer, right?
Correct. And the ash tree itself, it is not an especially sturdy tree. It's not an oak. And so ash trees are more prone to storm damage to begin with. They are.
Yes.
So they have some liabilities. They definitely have some liabilities.
Okay. I have another one, which is much smaller, but it's, leaning because of the light, and that would be, it's about 20 feet away.
Okay.
What would be a good tree that would tolerate our start? Because it's a large tree. It has a large
canopy
area covers.
Yeah.
Canopy, yeah.
Yeah. You would ideally want to find a place where the tree was not under the canopy of another tree. And if you can do that, then I would look at things like maples, oaks, lindens, honey locust, various other trees. But ideally, you want to have those planted outside the drip line of existing trees.
All right, Ron, good luck with that. I know a lot of people are facing hard decisions when it comes to ash trees. Marilyn is on the line next in Manchester. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a row of 7 lilacs along the front side of my yard. Last spring, the neighbor, who is a farmer, sprayed something on his field, and the buds on the lilacs died right there. Now, this spring, those branches look dead. Very few leaves came out. Very few buds on the back side of the trees. Are the lilacs going to come out of it?
Well, it doesn't sound good at this point, but I think I would be a little bit cautious and patient and wait. And I would probably wait until maybe late summer, mid to late summer, and then go out and make your final decision. If by mid to late summer you still have plants that look very, very weak, most of it's dead, then the likelihood of them recovering is not very good. But you might be surprised, and maybe in the next few weeks you might start to see a lot of new growth coming up. And if so, then I would be inclined to try to save those and get rid of the old wood, dead wood, and see how they recover. So I would be inclined to wait a little bit longer just to see what they're going to do, because they can still grow quite a bit this spring and summer.
All right, Marilyn, thanks a lot for your call. Here's a question from Art in Edgewood. Should grass clippings taken from a yard treated for broadleaf weeds by a commercial applicator be avoided as garden mulch because of the herbicide?
Right. We commonly suggest that if you're going to use a broadleaf herbicide, that you mow the lawn at least two or three times before collecting and using the clippings.
All right. And he has a second compost question. I've composted kitchen plant material for years to use in my garden. It occurred to me recently that when I compost tomato skins and seeds from the canning process, I might be creating a problem by spreading mildew and fungus. What do you think?
I don't really think so. The greater concern would be if you have plants that are diseased. If they have like early blight, late blight, or something like that, that's a much bigger concern.
Right. And those tomato skins have probably been boiled.
Yeah, they all should right. be okay.
all right, here's a question. Well, here's a comment from Amy who said, cover your basil. Just cover your basil. All right. And then,
you know, I don't consider myself a gambler, but, you know, I have some things outside myself I intend not to cover. So,
all right.
Whatever.
Fast and loose, Richard. I don't know. All right.
I may regret this next Friday, right. but maybe not.
This is a question from Andrew and Perry. I've just planted a young pear tree in my yard. It gets lots of sunlight. I was wondering if the pear tree will be a self-pollinator or if I need to plant a second tree.
Yeah, most pear trees do not pollinate themselves very well. So typically, we suggest planting two different varieties because they might produce a few by themselves, but if there's a second variety there for cross-pollination, they'll typically produce a full crop.
All right. And this is a question from Chris. I'd prefer not to spray Roundup that is too close to plants that I want to save. Can I apply it with a brush or a swab if I'm careful?
Absolutely. You can use a foam-type paintbrush. And you can also use like a piece of plywood as a shield if you need to, where you put it between the bad plants and the good plants.
All right. And finally, just a clarification from you, Alan. Lana was listening to our conversation about pond plants, and she heard the comment about blue flag, but she couldn't remember the full name. So if you wanted to plant that, how do you find it?
Blue flag iris, I think, is the common name, the full name.
All right. So that should help you out at the garden center. Alan Patillo, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Charity.
Alan Patillo, Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist. Richard Duran, thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome.
Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the program. We'd love to hear your suggestions for things you would like to hear on the program in the future. You can also follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. I'm there as well at Charity Nebbie. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Have a great weekend.